Funding for this program was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, as well as generations of families and friends who feel passionate about the programs they watch on Iowa PBS.
As legislators gather in Iowa's capital city of Des Moines, Governor Kim Reynolds lays out her vision for the 2021 legislative session amidst another year of full Republican control at the Iowa State House. In a rare evening speech, tonight is the 2021 Condition of the State address. Welcome to our coverage of Governor Reynolds' fourth Condition of the State address. It comes after a tumultuous year of campaigning and the governor presiding over Iowa's response to the COVID pandemic. And here in Iowa, Republicans still retain trifecta control of the governorship, the Iowa House, and the Iowa Senate. Hello, I'm David Yepsen. We're joining you tonight from Iowa PBS studios in Johnston as we preview the governor's address, and we'll interview minority Democratic leadership for their response afterwards. Now, here are some of the issues confronting Reynolds and State House legislators. Pandemic economic recovery, return to school for students and teachers, social justice and policing reforms, Republican push for tax changes. Now joining us at Iowa PBS studios is State House reporter and Radio Iowa News Director Kay Henderson. Kay, good to see you.
Good to see you.
You and I have covered a few of these. What kind of legislature is Governor Reynolds talking to?
Well, it is majority Republican. Republicans firmly in control the legislative branch of state government. There are 31 out of the 50 seats in the Iowa Senate occupied by Republicans. There's one opening when Marionette Miller Meeks was sworn in as a U.S. Congresswoman. There'll be a special election in the Ottumwa area later this month. In the House, there are 59 Republicans out of the 100 seats.
Okay. How does this differ from all the other Condition of the State speeches you and I have covered?
Well, A, it's at night. They're usually at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then secondarily, and most importantly, it's happening in the middle of a pandemic. People who are watching and are used to seeing the pomp and circumstance here may notice that there are not some familiar faces in the crowd. Many Democrats have chosen to watch in a remote location, probably at home, like many of the people that we're talking to right now.
What's your sense for the security presence at the state capitol? Or talk of increased security all over the country, but what do you sense here?
It was enhanced, and we'll see if she addresses that tonight.
The governor's entering the room, escorted by a group of legislators. There's always a committee to officially notify the governor of this speech, making her way to the speaker's dais.
This is a joint session, so it's a House and Senate meeting. So it's a senator who is sort of presiding over this event.
Pretty. I always think the House chamber is a very dignified place to do something like this, regardless of the time of day. Mm-hmm. Speaker Grassley, President Jake Highfield Chapman.
It is my pleasure to introduce Governor Kim Reynolds for her Condition of the State message to the 2021 session of the 89th General Assembly.
Please be seated. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, Lieutenant Governor, legislative leaders and members, justices and judges, my fellow Iowans. Our state constitution says that every year the governor must communicate to the General Assembly the condition of the state. That usually happens in the morning on the second day of the legislative session. But tonight, I'm breaking with that tradition so that I may speak directly to Iowans. It's been a year, and I'll let you fill in whatever adjective you want. COVID-19, civil unrest, a drought, a derecho. We've been beaten and battered in about every way imaginable, and some unimaginable. But together, we've met every challenge with bravery and outright grit. We're told that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance, character. From what I've seen, there's no shortage of character in the people of Iowa. And despite what we've been through, or maybe because of it, the condition of our state has never been stronger. We live in a place where 82-year-old Blanche Cheesick from Brett sewed over 1,000 masks and baked dozens of pastries for healthcare workers, where 17-year-old Tanner Kennan recruited his friends to start a grocery delivery company for the elderly, where an anonymous donor gave out more than $80,000 in gift cards from local businesses to every resident of Earlham, and where countless other Iowans donated food, time, and resources. Thousands of Iowans, truck drivers, manufacturers, grocery store clerks, meat processing workers, and so many more showed up to work every day to make sure that the people of this state and the world were fed. Police officers, social workers, and government employees worked around the clock to deliver PPE and to make sure that Iowans continue to receive the services that they depend on. Small businesses adjusted their hours and often how they operate to protect their employees and their customers. And nowhere was the dedication and commitment to others more evident than in our healthcare system. Nurses, doctors, technicians, pharmacists, EMTs, janitors, social workers, and thousands of direct care workers in our senior living communities. In 2020, you worked some of the longest hours in the most uncertain conditions. Your actions saved lives. Your spirit inspired us. And you didn't just provide medical care. Your patients often couldn't be with their loved ones, so you also provided them comfort and company. You sat with them when no one else could. You held their hand, facilitated calls to family, and in some cases, stood by them while they took their last breath. While many of us were shielded from the worst of the pandemic, you were on the front lines every day, and we cannot sufficiently express our gratitude, but we're going to give it the good old Iowa try. So please join me in thanking those heroic Iowans. Iowans are well accustomed to the extremes of Mother Nature's temper, but the derecho in August was unlike anything we've seen. Hurricane-force winds recorded as high as 140 miles an hour raged across our state. Over a third of our counties impacted. 584,000 households left without power. Thousands of homes damaged. Millions of acres of crops were flattened. And as grain bins crumbled, we lost over 100 million bushels of grain storage. It was a disaster of unprecedented scope. In Marshalltown, the derecho left behind three times as much debris as the F3 tornado that ripped through the city's downtown in 2018. And the scars will be evident for generations to come in places like Cedar Rapids and Marion, where they lost more than half of their tree canopy. We praise the dedication of the more than 200 National Guard members who deployed to help remove debris, the local police, fire, public works departments, and emergency managers who stepped up and served their neighbors tirelessly, and the dedicated staff of state agencies like the DHS, DNR, and the DOT, who pressed ahead when their state needed them. We thank the thousands of line workers who came from across the country to supplement the crews from Alliant, MidAmerican, and other utilities to restore electricity with astonishing speed, often to the applause of Iowans. I had the opportunity to speak with some of the line workers from out of state, and I heard not only that our disaster was as bad as the aftermath of hurricanes whose names have been retired, but also that Iowans showed more patience, more gratitude, and more hope than anyone else that they'd ever seen. Good corporate citizenship was put on display, not only by our power companies, but by essential suppliers like Hy-Vee and Fairway, who donated food, water, and supplies. It was shown by small business owners like Willie Ray Fairley, whose Willie Ray Q-Shack gave away hundreds of meals a day to people whose own refrigerator and stoves weren't working. Willie Ray didn't just fill hungry stomachs, he fed a sense of community, and that's what makes a disaster bearable. What happened this year went beyond Iowa Nice. You showed a humanity that rivals what most of us have seen in our lifetime. Our job now is to hold on to that humanity. 2020 left its mark on everyone, but not evenly. There are people across this state who are still hurting. Many lost their job or their business or even their home. And many lost loved ones to this horrible pandemic. For them and for anyone who lost someone this year, whatever the cause, saying goodbye was even harder than it usually is. You may not have been able to be with them while they were sick, to hold their hand one last time, or to fully celebrate their life at a funeral with all those they loved. So whether you're in the chamber or watching at home, please take a moment, bow your head, and remember those we lost this year and the loved ones they leave behind. Thank you. When I stood here last year, our fiscal health was strong. We had one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. Incomes were going up and our economy was roaring. And then 2020 happened. We took a hit like everyone else, but we didn't falter. Because of conservative budgeting, Iowa's diverse economy, and the decision to keep over 80% of our businesses open, and because of the tenacity of our people, Iowa isn't facing a massive budget shortfall like many states. As I stand here tonight, our unemployment rate has returned to 3.6%, one of the lowest in the country. And our GDP grew over 36% in the third quarter of 2020, outpacing the nation. Iowa is coming back, and we're coming back strong. Iowa's success has always been about turning obstacles into opportunities and overcoming adversity together. The post-COVID world won't be the same as the pre-COVID world, and it shouldn't. We've learned a lot. Entire sectors of our economy were forced to innovate overnight and adapt to survive. We can approach Iowa's economic recovery in a number of ways. We can return to where we were, which is realistic but still an ambitious goal. Or we can take what we've learned and the innovation that's been applied over the past 10 months and capitalize on that opportunity to reimagine, modernize, and possibly restructure everything from healthcare and education to our workforce and quality of life. It's about ensuring our future prosperity is widespread and reaches all people in all parts of Iowa, including those that too often feel left out when times are good. And that's why I formed the Economic Recovery Advisory Board this summer. Chaired by Ruan Transportation CEO Ben McLean, the 15-member board and 350 working group members volunteered their time and talents in meeting my charge to be bold, innovative, and direct about the challenges facing our economy. I want to thank them for their diligent work to make sure that we support every part of Iowa and every Iowan. Their report will be released soon, but there are a few big issues that we can begin to address tonight. The need for universal broadband is one of them. As we've seen during the pandemic, high-speed internet is as vital to our communities as running water and electricity. If they don't have it, they can't grow. Every year I've been governor, I've focused on expanding broadband to every community. And we're making progress, but not enough. About a third of our counties are still broadband deserts, where high-speed internet is rarely often offered, and for many Iowans, it's just not affordable. Iowa also has the second lowest broadband speeds in the country. I'm done taking small steps and hoping for big change. This is the time for bold action and leadership. Let's plant a stake in the ground and declare that every part of Iowa will have affordable high-speed broadband by 2025, and we'll get there by committing $450 million over that time period, which will leverage millions more in private investment, giving Iowa the biggest build-out of high-speed internet in the country. Has more households with all parents working than any other state, yet we've lost a third of our child care spots over the last 5 years. When schools abruptly closed last spring, a system already under stress was pushed even harder. Some families were able to adapt by working from home. Others leaned on grandparents, aunts and uncles, and family friends for support. In Pottawatomie County, a group of daycare providers and other partners teamed up to provide free daycare for essential workers. But many parents weren't so lucky and struggled to find ways to care for their children and still show up for work, often in roles that are essential to all of us. Even when the coronavirus is a distant memory, Iowa will still need an abundance of high-quality childcare, so that families can prosper and children can grow. Many of our communities and businesses are working together to address this issue. In Stewart, 17 local businesses joined together to purchase an empty building with plans to renovate and lease it to a child care provider. It's in our state's interest to encourage these types of public-private partnerships, which is why we created the Child Care Challenge last year. It's an innovative program that encourages employers, community leaders, and others to collaborate in developing childcare facilities. This year, we need to fund that program. So I'm allocating $3 million to jumpstart these public-private partnerships. I'm also using $25 million of childcare development block grants to further promote childcare startups. Every community has different needs and different resources. And just as the leaders in Stewart found a solution that fits their hometown, we want to facilitate local solutions in other places too. So let's remove the obstacles to high-quality, affordable childcare so that Iowa families can nurture their kids while parents maintain the maximum freedom to enter and remain in the workforce. As our economy comes back, we're again facing a familiar problem: more job openings than there are people who have the skills to fill them. And that's why we need to continue the work we started with Future Ready Iowa, a program that's designed to increase the number of Iowans with education or training beyond high school. Education or training, that's worth repeating. We have exceptional universities, colleges, and community colleges in this state. But not all skills are learned in a classroom. On-the-job training and reskilling are some of the most valuable ways to advance our workforce and increase Iowans' wages. We need to continue to find ways to recognize this type of experience. We took a big step in June by passing a significant licensing reform package. It didn't get a lot of attention at the time, but at the beginning of this session, we should stop to recognize how important it was. Iowa now has the most flexible licensing, reciprocity, and recognition laws in the nation, which sends a signal to the country that Iowa is open for business. And we're not done. This year, we'll begin the task of reviewing each of the licensing boards and commissions to make sure that they're serving their purpose. We must also continue the great strides that we've made by integrating work-based learning into K-12, into the K-12 curriculum. We know that many kids think of education differently when it involves real-life experiences. They see why education matters, and it can be really a key in helping them choose and prepare for a career that fits them. Many schools across the state are offering these amazing work-based learning experiences. Let's make sure that every high school student gets that same chance. I'm calling on the legislature to make that an expectation of all our schools. When Iowa families come together after work and school, they need a place to call home. Unfortunately, we have a growing mismatch between where job opportunities are thriving and where people can find affordable places to live. Some communities have rallied to buck this trend. Forest City hadn't seen a new affordable apartment complex in more than 25 years, so community leaders raised $4 million in financing by leveraging local and state resources, and a new apartment complex was built in 2017. In Davenport, leaders used the same public-private partnership to convert an old vacant school building into 41 affordable apartments, which were rented within 2 months. This project brought new housing to the historic riverfront, and it served as a catalyst for redevelopment. Forest City and Davenport exemplify the spirit of Iowa communities, but the reality is there aren't enough resources to go around. Last year alone, Iowa communities requested more than 3 times what was available. We must expand initiatives like these that address pent-up demand for affordable housing helping our communities thrive and our families move where opportunities await them. There's a lot to do this year, but if we tackle issues like broadband, childcare, workforce training, and affordable housing, we'll set Iowa on a solid path of economic prosperity for years to come. And remember that unlike many states, we're starting from a good financial position. We aren't looking at tough budget cuts, and we're certainly not looking at raising taxes. If anything, we need to continue the conversation about cutting taxes, and we can start by getting rid of the unnecessary triggers that were put in place in 2018. When we do that, we make Iowa more competitive, and we guarantee that our taxpayers can keep more of their hard-earned money. A high-quality education system is the foundation of our state. Historically, we've had some of the best schools in the nation, and I believe we still do. What many of our teachers and administrators did this last year was nothing short of amazing. In Clear Creek, Amana, Barb Hunt's special education students were struggling with virtual learning, so she worked with the transportation director, Denny Schreckengast, to convert a camper into a classroom, bringing the classroom to them. In Hinton, when the school went to hybrid model for a few weeks, teachers spent hours holding individual Zoom calls with students, sometimes going into the evening to make sure that they weren't falling behind. At West Sioux, teachers personally went to the homes of Spanish-speaking families who needed help setting up their internet. In Clarinda, the district was short on bus drivers, so Josh Porter, a school administrator with a CDL, jumped behind the wheel to make sure his kids could be in the classroom. And in Cedar Rapids, Noreen Bush, superintendent of the second largest school district in the state, and her team made heroic efforts to get her kids back into the classroom just weeks after many of their schools were ripped apart by the derecho. And she did it all while receiving chemotherapy. There are stories like this from all across the state. Teachers and administrators put their students first in uncertain and difficult times, especially as they implemented plans to safely and responsibly reopen schools. But this hasn't been the case everywhere. Over the last several months, I've heard the frustration from many parents, students, and teachers who didn't have the opportunity to go back to school. So let me share a few of those frustrations. I talked to a passionate teacher whose student hasn't logged in for class in 9 weeks, and there is nothing she can do about it. I visited with the parent of a child with special needs who is devastated by seeing her daughter's education and social progress fade because a computer screen isn't a substitute. I spoke to a middle school student who has to watch her younger siblings during the day and complete her own schoolwork at night. I heard from numerous parents whose children's school day consisted of 60 to 90 minutes of online instruction per day at the most. Nicole, a mother of 3 elementary students who since March have spent less than a week in the classroom. She told me she's struggling to facilitate her children's online learning while keeping up with her job. She said she feels like she's failing as a parent, a spouse, and an employee. These stories are heartbreaking. And let me assure you, Nicole, it's not you who's failing. The vast majority of our schools found a way to safely and responsibly reopen all day, Monday through Friday. It's past time that every district make that happen. As one parent told me, options are good, but if some parents get the option to go 100% online, why don't my kids get the option to be 100% in the classroom? And I agree. So tonight, I'm asking the legislature to immediately send a bill to my desk that gives parents the choice to send their children back to school full time. We can't wait any longer, and our kids can't wait any longer. If there's one thing that the pandemic has taught us about education, it is that our parents need choice. And it's not just in-person versus virtual. Sometimes it's about which school to attend altogether. When some schools remained closed or went part-time this fall, a lot of parents sent their kids to private school or opened enrolled. But not everyone had that option. Many parents can't afford private school, and because some of our larger districts prohibit open enrollment, they won't let you transfer to another public school. One parent I talked to said that a school administrator actually recommended that she buy a house in the neighboring district if she wanted her son to go to school in person. We need to fix that. School choice shouldn't be limited to those who have the financial means or are lucky enough to live in a district that's confident enough to allow open enrollment. So let's make choice an option for everyone. We can do that by making open enrollment available in all districts and by allowing our communities more flexibility to create public charter schools where there is a need for an alternative. And we should create education savings accounts for students who are trapped in a failing school. Let's give them another choice by making sure money isn't their barrier. Make no mistake, it's imperative that we have a strong public school system, which is why we have and will continue to prioritize school funding while many other states are cutting their education budgets. But school choice isn't a zero-sum game. It has the potential to raise the quality for all schools. And for those schools that do fall behind, it ensures that our children don't fall with them. Let's work together to make sure every child receives a quality education, regardless of income and no matter their zip code. In 2020, we saw an overwhelming call for racial justice in Iowa and across the nation. We heard that call and with bipartisan effort passed the More Perfect Union Act. I'm proud of that legislation and we're continuing to make criminal justice reform a priority. I'm also very proud of our law enforcement. They put their lives on the line every day, something we should never forget. And if we needed a reminder, last year's civil unrest and last week's attack on the Capitol provided it. Violence and anarchy are not acceptable, period. prayers are with the families of the Capitol police officers who sacrificed their lives to defend the beacon of our democracy and the people in it. And our prayers are with every other officer who defends us against those who are intent on violence. This summer, when protests gave way to rioting and looting in the Quad Cities, three Davenport police officers were ambushed. 32 rounds of gunfire were pumped into the truck that Sergeant Lansing, Lieutenant Benning, and Detective Sievert were in. The truck windows were shattered. Sergeant Lansing was shot in the leg, and multiple bullets struck his headrest. The truck took on so much fire that it could barely accelerate, but Sergeant Lansing navigated it to safety. In her Quad City Times column, Barb Ikus eloquently wrote, "That nightmare scene is precisely what police train for, but that the resulting courage cannot be taught. Their escape is astonishing," she said. "Most of us can't even imagine it. I couldn't agree more. Please join me in thanking these brave officers who were with us tonight." We should never take this bravery for granted, but in cities like Minneapolis, Portland, and New York, they have. They've embraced the attacks on law enforcement, and now their violent crime rates are rising for the first time in generations. That's not going to happen in Iowa, not on my watch. We should never be afraid to talk about ways to improve policing, but there will be no talk of defunding the police. Our men and women in blue will always have my respect, and I will always have their back. To that end, I'll be introducing a bill that protects law enforcement and continues our march towards racial justice. The bill will make it clear that if you riot or attack our men and women in uniform, you will be punished. We won't stand for it. The bill will also ban racial profiling and other forms of disparate treatment, because no actions should ever be taken based on the color of someone's skin. As Martin Luther King Jr. recognized, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So let's come together again like we did last year to support our law enforcement and racial justice. Let's make Iowa a safer place for everyone. When Iowans come together, we do big things. We've grown our economy, protected life and our Second Amendment. lowered the tax burden on Iowans, supported our farmers and producers by increasing demand for biofuels, protected our environment by promoting renewable energy, and so much more. Like this past year, when we watched healthcare in Iowa transform from a collection of competing hospitals and clinics to a single statewide healthcare system committed to collaborating for the sake of all Iowans. As we move forward, let's build on that collaborative and innovative spirit. In my budget, I'm proposing $1 million to encourage hospitals and clinics to start what's called a Center of Excellence. It's a program that aligns rural physicians with specialists, creating regional hubs that provide highly skilled care closer to where patients and their primary care providers live. So whether you're dealing with the trauma of an accident or the joy of childbirth, it's not just the quality of the team that matters, it's the proximity. I want a better system of care for all Iowans, regardless of where they live. I also want to make sure that when Iowans call 911 for an emergency, there's a quick response. I know members in this chamber are already working on a bill to improve rural EMS services, and I look forward to working with you this session. We must also continue our focus on mental health. While the virus threatened our physical well-being, the realities of last year placed unimaginable stress on so many Iowans. Seniors were isolated from friends and loved ones. Kids were kept out of the classroom and away from the stability it provides. And thousands of Iowans had their livelihoods turned upside down. In the last 3 years, we've reformed our mental health system, and we're continuing to make it better. I'm proposing to increase mental health funding by $15 million this year and another $15 million next to fully fund the reform efforts. And I know that our mental health regions are working on innovative solutions to address the unique needs of children who have been affected by the pandemic. And because of the legislation that we passed last year, which allows schools to host behavioral health sessions using telehealth, kids no longer have to leave school for hours to receive quality treatment. That's a lesson many of us learned over the last 10 months. Telehealth is a powerful tool that we should continue to encourage and expand. And it's not just for mental health. Thousands of Iowans experienced it firsthand this year, receiving treatment and checkups from their own home. In 2020, we asked so much of our healthcare providers, and they've met those expectations at every step of the way. Many of our hospitals were at the forefront of developing treatments for COVID-19, and the University of Iowa has been key in the development of vaccines. The availability of vaccines marks the most significant turning point since the pandemic. And I'm proud to say that Iowa is one of the states leading the nation in administering the vaccine. To date, nearly 100,000 Iowans, including our healthcare workers, have received their first dose. And several thousand have now received their second. And by January 25th, all 90,000 nursing home residents and staff will have received the vaccine, ensuring that Iowans most at risk are among the first to have this protection. I know we are all eager to be vaccinated and turn the corner, and wider distribution to more Iowans is imminent. But as we begin to put 2020 behind us, I have two requests for my fellow Iowans. First, let's not forget those neighbors who are still hurting. Reach out, keep volunteering, continue to stock food banks. Continue to show the country that it doesn't take a pandemic or a derecho to lend a helping hand. Second, Let's not return to normal. Let's be better. Let's think bigger. Let's be bolder. If anything, this year has shown us what we can accomplish and how fast we can do it. Hold on to that spirit, to that ingenuity, and that collaboration, to the feeling that we're working together for the greater good and not ourselves. If we can do that, if we can work with and for each other, then we will do great things. I believe in this state because I believe in you. I've seen what you've done. I've watched, sometimes with tears of pride in my eyes. And that's how I know that the condition of our state is strong. Because you are strong, stronger than you ever imagined. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the great state of Iowa.
That concludes Governor Kim Reynolds' condition of the state message for 2021. The governor getting the applause from a sparsely populated legislative chamber. COVID has really changed the nature of that event here. We're in prime time in the evening, just about a 45-minute speech, and many legislators are social distancing, and many others are not able to attend. So we're joined here again with Kay Henderson, Radio Iowa News Director. Kay, what do you see as the high points of the governor's speech?
As is the case, we learn things over time in advance of the start of the legislative session. We're thinking about that. She told us in advance that she would not be proposing her Invest in Iowa tax package again this year, putting it on hold because of the pandemic and the uncertainty. The new thing that we heard tonight in this speech was that she is proposing an exponential increase in state funding for broadband, $450 million over 3 years. Another new thing we learned tonight is that she's going to join two proposals together in regards to ending racial profiling, at least keeping track of arrests in some sort of data point, and then marrying that in a bill with legislation that would enhance the penalties for rioters and for those who harm police officers.
Yeah, it struck me that, you know, that this is not racial justice and improving policing is not mutually exclusive. She's joining the two together. It seems like a good way to get both items passed. I was struck by some of the other things she talked about. Child care, mm-hmm. big issue in economic development in the state, as well as how we treat our children. Job training programs, not enough just to have an education. You've got to be trained as well. Licensing reform. If you have a license in another state, it ought to be transferable here.
And also suggesting that she might go where Terry Branstad tried to a few years ago and actually reduce the number of professions in Iowa that require some sort of state license.
Yeah, it really starts to become an impediment to people getting jobs or transferring. And she mentioned the state has already made some progress there. But one of the things I think could be a real flashpoint here in this session are school attendance policies.
Right.
How do you think, what's she asking for, and how do you think it'll play out?
Well, as you just heard, she's saying that she wants it immediately. She wants the legislature to pass a bill that requires schools to offer 100% in-person attendance for students. She also wants some changes in how often attendance in a school district is taken. It's taken now just one time a year, and I think that might have an impact on the amount of money that schools get. We don't know that yet. And then she's also proposing something that would change Iowa's open enrollment law. For those who aren't familiar, if you live in a school district and you would prefer that your child goes to an adjacent district, in most areas of the state, you use this option and just enroll your student in that neighboring district. But in certain districts like Des Moines and Waterloo, where there are arguments by some that you have people moving out of the district because it is a majority-minority district, there are limits on open enrollment. And I think what you heard tonight was that she wants those limits gone.
You know, she also talked about improving mental health care. That was a big item last
right.
session. She was not able to, they had to abandon it once the pandemic occurred. What do you think will happen with that issue in this session?
Well, it's interesting. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Ankeny, said last week that Republicans might even be open to using some of the state surplus to address some of the infrastructure issues in the child health care, mental health care system.
And thank you, Kay. And we're joined now by House Minority Leader Todd Pritchard. The Democratic leader is from Charles City. Representative Pritchard, thank you for taking time to be with us. It's good to have you here.
Always my pleasure, David. I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
What's your overall reaction to what you heard tonight from the governor?
Well, I was interested as far as what we didn't hear about. I would have liked to have heard some assistance or at least some focus on fixing Iowa's health care system. I would have liked to have heard some things about workers and small businesses affected by COVID and maybe some more direction as to how we're going to get workers and small businesses, the backbone of Iowa's economy through the pandemic. And so I would have liked to have heard about those couple of things. And then I was really trying to unpack some of the proposals for the public schools. And it almost looks like there's a little bit of warfare with our public school system that I think could really backfire on what she may be trying to do with our school system here in the state.
Representative Pritchard, do you think that could be the big flashpoint of this session, the argument over school attendance? You folks in the legislature and policymakers are in a real dilemma here over how you keep kids and staff safe, but at the same time, we've got to get our kids back in school to help them with their education, to enable parents to go back to work, to get the economy going again. How do you solve that dilemma? How do you broker an agreement here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's no question it's a dilemma that school districts across the state are trying to do with their specific situation. You know, the pandemic has had a different course in Charles City than it has in Des Moines or Iowa City or a larger community. And so, you know, what I really felt from the governor is that she's going to make the decision, she's going to make the call as far as how schools are going to handle the pandemic from here forward. She's asking for that type of legislation. And I think, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. What we're focused on as Democrats is we want to see schools return to 100% instruction Monday through Friday. Who doesn't want to see that? That would be something that's great. But we want to make sure it's done safely. We want to make sure that it's done in a way that protects children and students. And so we think that we can do that. But, you know, her simply saying from Des Moines, you know, this is how all schools are going to handle this from a safety standpoint, I really don't think that's good policy. I don't think that's appropriate for every district.
Kay Henderson has a question.
In your view, what is an education savings account, and is that something that you might support?
Well, yeah, I'm not. You know, as I understand the term, I think it's a diversion of public dollars for to be used in another school setting, if it's for private school or something for that. You know, I think the bottom line is I just fundamentally disagree that it's a zero-sum type of equation. That I think by diverting money from public schools to, you know, something else, whether it's a private school or some other form of instruction, is necessarily going to hurt our public school system. And I just don't see how that serves Iowans. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about putting tasks or expectations on the schools, but you can't take away resources and then expect them to also give us the services that she's talking about with mental health. You think about how important schools are to rural communities and how, you know, wonderful they've done by and large through the pandemic with food programs and these type of activities. So, we can have it both ways where we can put more burdens on public schools but then take away funding. That's really concerning.
Okay.
You have long supported legislation that would ban or at least try to find out about racial profiling in Iowa. Do you believe that that would pass in concert with in the same bill as she proposed tonight that would enhance penalties for attacking police and for protesters?
Yeah, no, so I think this is something where I do see that, you know, we can kind of do two things. We can make the streets safer for everyone. We all want to make the streets safer for our law enforcement officers, for their tough job. You know, we had three of our finest police officers here from Davenport who survived a harrowing situation. We want to make sure that they have the tools, but we know that what makes police officers safer is that we have, you know, proper training, proper equipment, and proper policing techniques. And so, you know, this is something that we're very interested on because we think that really is a zero-sum game, that we can make streets safer for the public and for our officers. So that's something that we look forward to working with the governor on.
Todd Pritchard, thank you very much for breaking away to give us a few of your thoughts about this message. We look forward to having you on the Iowa Press Show again soon and so we can talk more about the Democratic priorities in this session. Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
I want to thank Representative Pritchard for joining us tonight. That wraps up our coverage of Governor Reynolds' 2021 Condition of the State Address. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., Iowa PBS provides special coverage of the 2021 State of the Judiciary speech from Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Susan Christensen. And on Thursday at 10 a.m., Iowa PBS provides coverage of the Condition of the Iowa Guard speech. For our entire Iowa PBS crew down at the state capitol in Des Moines, and out here in Johnston, I'm David Yepsen, and thanks for joining us today.
Funding for this program was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, as well as generations of families and friends who feel passionate about the programs they watch on Iowa PBS.